It's snake oil, I think, for a lot of people. It's the worst technical solution.
Is it less than $1 billion?
I have zero clue, right?
Today, I'm joined by Thorsten Ball out of Germany. Thanks so much for coming on, Thorsten.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so you're the author of two amazing books, Writing an Interpreter in Go and Writing a Compiler in Go. And we're not going to really talk about them. you've talked about them a lot. They're fantastic books. I definitely think everyone listening to the podcast should go check them out. But I invited you because I like the books, but there's a lot of podcasts out there talking about the books. I want to talk to you about, honestly, more about your blog slash newsletter. Is it a blog? Is it a newsletter?
It's a newsletter slash Substack slash whatever, weekly publication. I don't know. Yeah, newsletter.
This is registerspill.thorstenball.com,
exactly,
right?
Registerspill.thorstenball.com. The idea behind the name was, it's been nearly a year. In April last year, I started this. And the idea was blogging. There's always this high barrier that I guess everybody sets for themselves. And then, you know, you want to write about something and then you go, and then I should also add this and explain this and blah, blah, blah. And then look, 5 weeks go by and you haven't written anything. So I set myself the goal of writing one thing every week and setting a timer and saying, I'll just dump what's in my head. That's the register spill. Dump what's in my head, 60 minutes, whatever it is, I'm going to hit publish. And that's, you know, how this came to be. And that's still what it is. People can sign up, registerspill.com. I use Substack for, you know, even though they have pop-ups and whatnot, but for the specific reason that I don't want to deal with any of the infrastructure, and email has nasty infrastructure. It's not as easy as a blog, I guess. So yeah, low effort, once a week, whatever's on my mind.
Okay, very cool. It's a great blog. There's in particular two articles that we're going to kind of break down. Jumping into the first article, it's negotiation when product and engineering meet. Can you tell me, like in your own words, what got you thinking about this article? What's the problem with product teams and engineering teams?
So I wrote this after, you know, to give a little bit of my background here. Worked the last 5 years, nearly 5 years at Sourcegraph. I was a engineer, you know, something like a staff engineer at one point. Manager, went back to being an engineer. Before Sourcegraph, I worked in two startups in Germany here, mobility startups. And all three jobs were pretty much product engineering. So I didn't work in research. I didn't work in, you know, agency contacts or something like this. It was, we're building a product. We have product owners slash product managers. We have designers and we're building a thing. And in all of these contexts, I noticed that people approach the relationship between engineering and product in a sometimes abstract way. And I think my suspicion is that people don't know why certain processes are being done. They only see the process. They only see, this is the meeting I go to every, you know, 2 weeks, for example, but they don't understand why. And that leads to different things. And concrete example, engineers sometimes think, oh, I need to put estimates on this ticket because there's a field in Jira that says estimate and somebody wants an estimate. That's why I have to do this. God damn it. Why do I have to estimate this? I can't estimate this. That's not why we do estimates. We do estimates because somebody somewhere, probably a PM that you should talk to, wants to decide what to build next. And an estimate can help you decide what to build next. Because if the option is between building, say, a pool in your garden or a shed, and you have a fixed budget of time or money, and then the estimate says, yeah, building a pool would take, I don't know, 12 weeks and building a shed would take 1 week. And then you go, we only have 3 weeks of time, so let's build the shed. I don't care whether it's 1 week or 2 weeks, but I know we can get it done in 3 weeks. That's what the estimate is for, like choosing what to work on and how many people to use and stuff like this. I think there's a lot of problems in companies where people mistake the process or say the fields they have to fill out in a form for the actual thing that's being asked of them, or that the goal that we want to reach. A lot of people forget why we do certain things.
I've definitely heard engineers say things like, estimates don't work, or this can't be estimated. There's no way to know, you know, how long this is going to take. And there's like, in my opinion, there's like a bit of truth to that, in the sense that like, sometimes it's, you know, your estimates will be inaccurate and it's hard. But in my experience, the majority of things actually can be estimated with relative accuracy, especially if what you're working on is like fairly mundane stuff. If you're not like in cutting edge research, building something fully from scratch. And, you know, the premise of your article is basically around like how should we have that conversation between engineering and product. So I want to just like lay out a few things for listeners, because a lot of the listeners of this podcast are like pre-first job and might not even really be knowing what we're talking about. So when we talk about engineering and product, what we're really talking about is like engineers, people that like write code that does stuff. Product, these are people, their primary responsibility is to decide like, what are we going to build next? And they're not just making decisions. Well, I should say good product managers aren't just making decisions in a vacuum based on what they like feel like. It's more of like a, we're going to talk to customers, right? We're going to gather feedback. We're going to try to make data-driven decisions, whatever. And the cost-benefit analysis that you laid out earlier with like the shed and the pool, I feel like that's really easy to visualize if you're thinking about it as like you're one singular person making the decision, and you know how much it's going to cost to get the shed or the pool, and you know you want both, but you know that if the shed is 10 times cheaper, that that's the right call. It seems like the problems arise when now there's multiple people involved and only one of them knows how much things cost, right? One of them knows that the shed is 10 times cheaper and the pool is 10 times more expensive, but that person also doesn't know what they're going to like more. So you've got like one person that knows the cost, and you've got, in theory, one person that has a better understanding of like the value of the delivered thing. And that's kind of the breakdown between product and engineering. Am I doing like,
yeah,
is this making any sense?
That makes sense. The way I would phrase it is, and this is also, you know, for, like you said, people on their first job or even before, there's a lot of differences between different companies here and different teams within a single company. But roughly what I mean is, product is a product owner or product manager. And that means it's a person who decides roughly what is on the roadmap for a product. And they do this by talking or getting to know the customer, and also talking to the business, meaning, you know, your CEOs, your whatever, head of sales, all of that. They try to find out what are the demands of the product. And then what they do is they listen to all of these demands or the pain points, or they talk to customers whatsoever. They look at the items on, you know, unordered items, and then they order them by, say, how much effort is this going to take? Or how many customers will like this? How much revenue will we get from this? And then they order this. But they can only order this if they know, you know, how much something costs. If they have, say you have three items in front of you. One is port our app to Android. Say you have an iOS app. The second one is more notifications, push notifications. And the third one is make the app start faster, something like this. And if they don't know any, like how long something would take, right? How do they order it? Because if, say, make the app start up faster, that it could be an endless thing where you ask an engineer and they go, oh man, like our app boots so slow, but in order to make it faster, we would have to rip out the SQLite database. We have to change the way we initialize our views. We have to change how we talk over the network, blah, 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 blah. Or they talk to an engineer and the engineer says, you know why our app boots up so slow? Because we load everything and then we throw it away. It's a bug. It takes half a day to fix it. And that's what the PM is after. Like, knowing, is it one or the other? Like, where do I rank this? So that's, you know, that's the product side. And then they take this roadmap after it's prioritized investment whatsoever. And they go to engineering and say, look, folks, like, this is what I want you to work on. Like, this is the most important thing we can do for the product. And then this is what my article is about. Engineering then usually takes, not usually, sorry. In the worst cases, when it goes wrong, they take what product says and don't push back and don't say no, or don't say you're wrong here. They think, well, product asks us to port our app to Android. That's what we do. But my point in that article is that whenever product comes to you, it is your duty, in air quotes here, your duty as an engineer to make sure that this is an informed decision, that product has all the information they need to decide whether this truly is the thing that we should be building right now. Information such as porting to Android is going to take us 8 months. And while we're doing this, we can't add any more features to iOS because it's only two of us. And we will fall back behind other feature requests. And in the end, it will just be an MVP that doesn't work as well. You know, something like this. And again, like the point of the article is engineers often walk in these conversations and they go, well, you know, product decided that we should do this. I guess we're going to port to Android. And then they don't say anything and they walk off and then they try to build it and they know it's going to fail, but they still attempt to. And then it all falls apart. And I think what you should do as an engineer is you should say, okay, product, you want this. Here's what I know. Here's what I know about building this. Here's the costs. Are you aware of all of these costs? And if then product still says yes, because turns out that 90% of our market uses Android and we're missing so much revenue, we need to port to Android. That's fine, right? But you need to give them all of the information and actually act like an engineer and find out what it is they want. Because it turns out maybe, you know, porting to Android is maybe a bad example. But say this was 10 years ago. I was talking to somebody in our company and they said, look, you need to build a dashboard in the backend, like in the admin area of our app. You need to build a dashboard because I wanted blah, blah, blah. And we're like, a dashboard and graphs and, you know, back then using D3.js and whatsoever and rendering this and client side and, you know, what? And then we talked to him and then one of the senior engineers back then, and I'll never forget this. That's why I'm talking to you about this. But he said, well, how about a spreadsheet export? How about we just give you the Excel file of this data and you can download it and open it in Excel? And he's like, perfect. Solves my problem.
Even better.
Exactly. Even better. And I guess my point is a lot of engineers would have built a dashboard instead of pushing back and saying, what is it that you actually want to solve? Like, what is your problem? Why do you want this? And, you know, that's your job. You don't want to be the guy who just builds everything that's being asked of you. You want to actually solve problems that people have.
Let's say you'd taken on this dashboard project and you'd built it in like a day, which is, you know, maybe wildly faster than you actually maybe would have been expected to. You could look at that as a huge success, but it actually would have been better just to have the spreadsheet and that would have taken an hour or whatever. So like, even if you relentlessly execute on the wrong thing, it still can be not as good. I have an interesting story about this, very similar idea. But I was working at this company. We had a mobile app, and I'm not a mobile developer. I'm on the back end side of things, but I happened to be leading a team where a couple of the developers were responsible for the mobile app. And we were being asked by product for a very specific UI design, very specific like tab structure in the mobile app. And they were pointing to Twitter as an example of, see, this is possible. You should be able to do this very quickly. And we were looking into it and there wasn't an easy way to do it in React Native. Like it wasn't like a built-in module of that API. But you know, maybe if we were outside of that framework, it would have been simpler or whatever. And we were being pushed into this specific design, and my engineers on the team, they were just like, all right, let's just do this. We'll just like eject from React Native. We'll write some native code. We'll make this thing happen. Product needs it. They've decided it's important. Like, no, like let's present to them the React Native docs. There's like 10 menus in here we can choose from. They all do basically the same thing. We show it to them. They're like, oh yeah, pick that one, right? And then like five lines of code later,
yes,
we've got a menu that's working.
Exactly.
But that could have derailed us for like three weeks.
That's exactly
and
this.
And added tech deck. Yeah.
This, go to them and say, what is it that you want? And they go, well, you know, I don't know, tabs, it's, well, I don't want to lose the state that I have in this and just want to switch over to whatever. And then you could go, yeah, I can give you, you know, here's all of the options I have. Here's the other views that I can give you. And then they go, yeah, you know, I can do it. It's just, I think it's the same with like estimations and all of this stuff where engineers really get lost in, I don't know what it is, like the literal meaning of things. and they forget why things are being done. And to give you an anecdote here, this was also 10 years ago. No, not 10 years ago. But I gave my wife a ring, and I'm trying to come up why. It wasn't the engagement ring, but I think it was an old ring that my grandmother had, and it didn't fit her. It had to be made smaller. And we went to a jewelry store, and I have zero clue about jewelry, like zero. And we went in there, and we asked, you know, like the woman there at the counter, like, how much would it cost to, can you make this smaller? Yes. How much would it cost to make this smaller? And she goes, I don't know. I can't tell you. Like, just give me, like, roughly, like, is it, you know.
Less than $1 billion.
I have zero clue, right? It was a gold ring, I guess. And I was like, I don't know. And she's, nah, I don't know. I can't. It's so hard. It depends. And we have to send it off. I'm like, and then I said, so is it $30, $300, $3,000? And she looked at me and she goes, $35, $36, $37. You know, she couldn't nail down the price down to like €2 or €3.
But that's, it was within like 30.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So that's what I think often happens though, right? When people go, can you estimate this? And I don't think 99% of people who ask for estimates are after, will this take 1.5 days or 2 days? What most of them care about is this 1 day, or is it 5 days, or is it 5 weeks? Yeah. You know? And but people
orders
get lost
of magnitude.
In this. Yeah, like, orders of yeah. magnitude. And then I guess you know, people start talking about like the points or large, extra large and whatsoever. But I think that helps when people get lost in this too. But think of, why are you doing what you're doing right now? You're giving estimates so somebody else who doesn't know the technology as well as you do can make informed decisions about when and how, with whom to build something, right? And in this case, it was me trying to decide whether I can afford to have this ring made smaller or not. And whether it was $35 or $37 wouldn't have made a difference. But whether it was, you know, $30 or $3,000 would have made a difference.
You were the product manager of the ring, and the jeweler
exactly.
was the engineer.
Exactly, she was
right?
the engineer, yeah. Damn it, yeah.
Damn it. I'm a product manager. Shit. Okay, so I've done a lot of thinking about, as I'm sure every engineer has that has more than just a few years of experience, about estimates, because this is like a hotly debated topic and it pisses everybody off. I have landed on the opinion the last couple of years that I would rather just give a time estimate and have an understanding that it's not perfect. And that's my preferred system, as opposed to like the weird reader, in my opinion, weird and insane redirection of like, well, we're not going to use time. We're going to use complexity as our unit of measurement, and we're going to measure it in t-shirt sizes. What do you think about that? Have you found any of those, like, you know, we're going to measure complexity in t-shirt sizes? Is that useful?
Yeah. So I went through a bunch of these over the years. I think what has always worked best was when a team uses the same unit, meaning the best unit in the teams that I worked in the companies I worked in, you know, always in the context, whatever, it all depends, but was wall clock time. Say a ticket had a 2-day estimate, then I would expect, you know, oh, if Lane starts working on this on Monday, he's probably done by Wednesday. Meaning he can probably do 2 of these in a week. That's what this is about. Just to say wall clock time, because I've seen people, you know, say, yes, this is 2 days. And then it wasn't done after a week. And then they said, well, you know, 2 days. Yeah, it's like, you know, 16 hours of work, but there's also code reviews and there's meetings. And then, you know, CI failed and whatnot. And to me, the estimate is based on realistic time to get this done. Meaning, yeah, you start, when is it done? And the more experience you get, the more or the better you can estimate actually what might go wrong. You know, like say, I don't know, say, You have to ship some shell scripts to Kubernetes cluster via an NFAR or something like this. Sure, should be 5 minutes. But if you've done it a bunch of times, you go, there's escaping issues. Then, you know, I need to get the credentials again to test this. Do we have a test cluster? Blah, 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 blah. All of this stuff. Then you go, half a day, you know, something like this.
Mark's out at lunch. I got to get the creds from like him.
Exactly.
Like, yeah.
And then the other rule we had was often we don't do anything under a day. Like half a day, I think that's debatable. Like there's small stuff that you can do in a half a day, but it's often also goes wrong with exactly this. Like you say it's half a day, something goes wrong, and then you cannot do two half day things in one day. Again, it depends on why are you doing this? Are you estimating for yourself, for your engineering team? And you sit there and you have a planning meeting and you go, what do we want to do the next 2 weeks? And then, oh, Lane is on support. He's going to fix some tickets or whatever. How many can we assign to you? Right. And then it's look like we have one with 3 days, one with 4 days. It's 7 full days plus one with 1 day. Could be doable in 2 weeks. Right. But it's not. Yeah. We're going to give you 3 with 8 days. That's what this is about. If you then, you know, have to talk to products and they are interested in, say, the epics or the larger things, we might be talking about weeks. Is it 1 week? Is it a month? Is it whatsoever? Depends. But I found, yeah, like the, what you said, like, you know, the you always end up converting back to time. Like, even if we talk about extra large or whatever it is, you know, 3 points, 1 point, whatsoever, you always end up with, oh, yeah, it's 2 points because, and then what? Because it's going to take some time, you know, and then you have this estimate in your head already, so you can might as well put it down.
Like, there's always going to be some conversion back to time. So if you're not doing it, somebody else is. If it's the CEO of the company asking what's shipping this quarter, right? Like, someone's converting back to time. Customer is converting back to time, right? When is my feature getting fixed? They don't want to be told it's going to be a, you know, extra large t-shirt before they get their feature.
What also worked well, I think, is sometimes you put like a range on where you say, this is going to take 5 to 8 days or something like this, you know, and then we're talking about why are you doing certain things. Sometimes you put on 3 to 10 days, which is a completely useless estimate because you don't know, you know, when do we do this? Like when, you know, oh, I have 10 days available. Let's do this risky thing that apparently nobody can estimate. But there might be value in giving this estimate because the next person who comes along, you know, thinks, what is wrong? What is up with this? Like, why couldn't they estimate this? Oh, that means probably there's a lot of question marks involved here. There's a lot of unknowns. So we cannot estimate this. And then you might as well put a next label on it that says needs a prototype or a spike or whatever. Then you go, okay, 10 days or 3 to 10 days. That basically means we don't know what this is. So then how about, Lane, you take 1 day next week, you look at this. 1 day, you try to go as fast as possible, build a prototype, and then you might find out whether it actually takes 3, 6, 7, or 10 days.
I love those kinds of, like, I'd even like assign tickets. I mean, they weren't, it's like literally a sentence on a, you know, Kanban board or something, but like, we don't know how long it's going to take. Let's figure out how long it's going to take to figure out how long it's going to take. And what I mean is we're just going to set a cap. Like, just spend no more than, you know, half a day looking into this. Is it something we can import a library for? Or is it something that we're going to have to build custom, right? I'm a huge fan of that.
Product also loves this, right? Where it's, you know, product comes to you and says, how long does it take for us to port to Android or whatever? And say you're on React Native, right? React Native has built-in support for iOS and Android. But I'm not up to date, but I don't, maybe not everything converts evenly, right? You go, we don't know how long it would take. But then you as engineer can go, hey, product, here's a proposal. How about I take 1 day next week to investigate this? Like, do all of our views convert smoothly to Android? And then they go, yeah, like this is one, yeah, this is worth 1 day versus, you know, not knowing ever how this is going to go. So I think this is also, it's the same thing. Like, what does the other person want? What can I give them? Can I help them make more informed decisions?
I have a story. I promise it'll tie in. So I'm not a car person. Like, I know very little about cars. Like, basically, I know not to believe that I need to buy headlight fluid. And that's about as far as I get. Like, anything else seems to be a mystery. And when I go into, like, a mechanic shop to get my car looked at, I can be completely taken advantage of, in the sense that they could tell me whatever, you know, they can make up stuff that's wrong with the car. I don't know how much I'm going to pay. If I go to another mechanic, they might tell me something completely different, in which case I know somebody's lying, but I still don't know who. I wonder how much of this conversation that we're having is just solved by having more technical leadership, right? So like a big fear that I've heard around estimates is like, well, I'm worried that if I give an aggressive estimate and then I don't meet it, it's actually a deadline. And because the person who's judging me is non-technical, it's all they have to go on. So if I give them a fast deadline and then I'm slow, they think I'm slow. Whereas like to me, that seems like a solved problem. If my manager is technical and I set an aggressive estimate and I miss it, at least I can go to my manager and explain why. And they'll just like, oh yeah, that makes sense. You're not lying. Is this really the problem that we need more technical leadership?
I mean, I guess the answer for mine is always, I think this is one of the hills I'm willing to die on. Maybe people sometimes say as an engineering manager, you don't have to be technical. And, you know, we're going to talk about unpopular opinions, but I'm just going to say, I think you need to be technical because for exactly what you just said, if you are a non-technical manager in a car shop and you don't know, you know, whether an oil change takes 20 minutes or 2 days, you're going to miss a lot of stuff that's going on. You don't understand the work. People management is all well and good, but you need to know what the work is. What problems are we as a company solving and how are we solving them? How do the pieces here fit together? How does the end product, you know, how is it made up in the end? Estimates and juniors not knowing this, that's one thing. And the manager can then jump in and go, you know, yes, I know that my junior engineer has told you that, you know, this will be done in half a day, but look, I know that this is not going to take half a day or whatever. Like that's already valuable because they've seen some things and maybe it is, you know, nobody ever gets staging to run or stuff like this. Or, you know, it's really hard to write an integration test for this. So he's going to be blocked on this 4 days, something like this, just knowing what they're working with. And the other thing too is looking inward, not towards product, but looking inward and to take this in a different direction. But if you're a technical manager, you also can judge, you know, how much pain or how much fun certain types of work are. And if you're a technical engineering manager, you might say you have a classic, you know, sprint planning whatsoever, and you go around and you assign tasks. And then you as a technical manager, you realize, oh, you know what? Lane has been fixing these YAML issues for 2 weeks now. He's fed up. So this time I'm going to give him a nice ticket.
Or like he's really bad at YAML.
Yeah, but this, I know how much he's hurting. I know how what a big pain in the ass is, so I'm going to give him some good tickets. But if you don't know, you know, what they're doing day to day and how painful it is to debug CI, where you have to, you know, do like 120 try again, test, hopefully this works, commits. Blah, blah, blah. All of these commits. If you've never done this before, then you might think, oh, isn't this fun? You know, booting up machines in the cloud and running CI. That sounds cool, you know? But if you're actually doing it, you're like, no, I would love to do anything else. This sucks. I don't want to do this. So I guess knowing about the work and being technical helps you have more empathy with the team and, you know, make better decisions for them. So to tie this back to your estimates, I fully agree.
This is a hill we can die on together, at least, if we're going to die on it. I'm a huge fan of engineering managers being technical. The companies I've worked at where my manager was technical, it was night and day between just like how much I enjoyed working at the job and how productive I was. Because like when your manager is technical and you have a problem, especially if they're like a more senior engineer than you, like you go to them with the problem, not only do you not have to worry about them, like, you know, worrying that they can't trust you or that, you know, you're making up estimates, like all of that is solved, but also like they might have ideas that can even help you, right? Or you can learn from. Like there's an incredible amount of advantages to it.
I guess it wasn't called a manager back then, but one of my first team leads, you know, or then manager, he was and still is highly technical. And what he did, and I think that's really important for leadership, is he told us what good looks like or what's acceptable and not acceptable. Meaning, you know, sometimes he would say, guys, because it was just three of us, he's like, guys, we went down again. Yes, like production was down for 45 minutes. That's unacceptable. That's not good.
That's bad. Yeah.
That's bad. And we know we fucked up because we did our YAML, whatever. We need to get better than this.
Seems
and
to always be YAML.
Yeah, well, I guess. Sorry, YAML. But most of this comes from a place of understanding and knowing, you know, when he would say something like this, he wouldn't say you wrote shit code because he wanted to blame you. But most of the time when he said something like this, he knew that you took a shortcut and you knew it too. And then you felt bad because you realized, oh, he's setting the bar high. He's saying, you know, no, I shouldn't use duct tape and,
you know, bubblegum and popsicle sticks here. And he caught me. So now I'm trying to do better. And if you don't know what the people are working with, then you might think, yeah, duct tape and popsicle sticks, that's a perfectly valid solution. You go ahead, we shipped it. But I want somebody in there with me saying, this is what good looks like. Do better than this. Like, here's how you can do better than this. Which is also, I think, often done when somebody is technical.
It's funny how many things keep tying into this hill that I'm slowly murdering myself on. But I've seen the case where you have a non-technical manager and they're trying to inspire excellence. They're trying to, you know, get the team to raise the bar, so to speak. But because there's kind of a lack of expertise in the field, what it looks like is just, well, I guess, like, let's do 100% code coverage, right? Or these like really broad strokes of like, there's just not enough of a detailed view, I think, into the actual like quality of the work that's being done. And so you get these, you know, kind of high level requirements from the non-technical people kind of passed down from on high. And to me, that always seems like a disaster.
I agree. I think that is, again, this is a good point. I think it's, there's this uncanny valley type of thing where people get caught in like semi-technical things where they, you know, for example, what you said, high test coverage. And if you're really technical, you know, that's just a placeholder for something else. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't give us anything. Or metrics or whatever it is. What I would accept if somebody is maybe not technical, but if they have a really good product sense or they really know what they want. To make this concrete, say you're building a to-do application, right? And maybe they have zero clue about which programming language whatsoever you use. But if they say, look, this does not work. Why is this jittery? Why is this button like this? Why does this keep flashing? Why does this old checked off task pop up again and then disappear? Like, if somebody can do this and set a bar and say, this is what good looks like and keep the team accountable for this, that can go a long way. Right. It doesn't have to be, oh, I would use blah, blah, blah to write this and this technology and that technology, but just being able to judge the work, I think that's really important, to say this person did good work, and saying this from a place of, you know, understanding or knowledge, whatever level that may be. But having proxies and saying, oh, you know, Lane did great work because he built a thing that our customer wanted and now we have to check off on the list, but not ever looking at the thing that you actually build and not ever playing around with it and also not understanding how it was built with what amount of tests and with what, you know, quality. I think that doesn't work. I don't think that leads to good, you know, good teams producing good software.
I completely agree. And it can sound like I've been pretty hard on like management and product people. Like, hey, you guys need to kind of understand the coding side better so you can make better decisions around cost. It goes both ways. And engineers that have a good sense of like what good product looks like or what their customers want, that goes a long way too.
Yeah, that's true. There's a lot of analogies about management and engineers and whatnot that don't work. But say you have a sports coach, basketball coach. Can you be a good basketball coach if you don't know the game of basketball? Ted Lasso, I guess, you know, would disagree. But I disagree with Ted Lasso. I think, sure, you might not. Maybe you don't have to be a player. But how can you be a good coach if you don't love the game and don't want to win and don't understand that it's a good thing to, you know, how it feels to, you know, win the game winning 3 points in the last second? Coming back to engineering, how well do you know software? Do you know what good looks like? Do you know how to build great software? Have you ever thought this is good software and this is bad software? Do you have taste for this? That's what this is about, on some level at least.
Cool. I think we're pretty aligned there. Like I said, I really enjoyed that article. Now I want to ask you some questions about your other article, about your unpopular opinions, because I was able to pluck some out. Some of them I agree with. Some of them I'm not sure if I agree with. We're about to find out.
The pizza ones, yeah.
I left that one out, but I agree with you on the pizza one. What was it?
Nice.
You,
doesn't
matter if you had pizza yesterday. Like
Dad, but I also said today, pineapple, right? On pizza is fine. And
oh, I love pineapple on pizza.
Three people reached out to me. Like, the most comments and emails I got about this article were about the pizza.
We just lost half our audience, by the way. They just turned off their podcast player.
And then I did one more and wrote on Twitter a couple days later that somebody at work was saying, hey, I read your article I also like pineapple on pizza. And I'm like, yes, you know what? I also started guiltily admitting, like, yes, I also started dipping some pizza slices in barbecue sauce. And then I tweeted this.
I don't know about this.
Yeah, wait. And then now we're going this. Off the rails. And then more people reached out to me and went, dude, a colleague from Italy, he's like, I read your tweet and I'm going to pretend I didn't read it, man. So
pizza. Yeah, I was gonna say there's no way the Italians are getting on board with that one.
Yeah, slippery slow pizza in a literal and non-literal sense, I guess.
Okay, your first one that we need to tackle is not every company is for everybody. I don't know exactly what you mean, but mm-hmm. I want to know. What do you mean by that?
So what I mean is I basically only ever worked in smallish companies. Meaning I started in a startup with 4 engineers. Then we grew and grew and grew. And I think when I left that one, we were 25 engineers. Then I joined another company that had 200 engineers. And then I started working at Sourcegraph and we were back to 10 engineers, 15 engineers maybe. And I don't know what the highest number was, but I think we were at 90 at some point. But it's all relatively, right? Like this could be still one org in FAANG companies whatsoever. But what I've seen is that people join these small startups and they expect things to work like they do at big corporations. Like from processes to say benefits whatsoever to engineering culture to career progressions, all of it. I think if you join a startup with nothing more than 10 engineers, you can't go, not necessarily can go in there and ask for a career progression plan or a 401k or whatsoever. They all look like companies you can apply to. And yes, they all look for software engineers, but it's a different game they're playing. And you might want to play the game that Microsoft is playing, but you might not want to play that other game. And I think people want to hire a lot of people. People want to join companies. A big problem in hiring is hiring for culture fit. And then you only hire people that are like you and you miss out on great candidates. I think that's a problem. But I think at a certain point, you have to be crystal clear and say, look, this is the culture here. This is the company we have. This is the game we're playing. Meaning, for example, we're a 10-person startup. We want to get as big as possible in as fast as possible and then sell whatever, you know, if somebody's open. Or they say, no, I want to grow and be the biggest company we can be. Or they say, we want to stay small. So you need to be clear about the expectations here. And I think that gets lost. Like, I guess that's all I was trying to say here, that look, like you might have different things you want from work. And even though, yes, it says software engineering job, and yes, you were a software engineer and you want to be a software engineer, this job might, and this company might not be for you because they're after different things. Like they might work or love to work longer than 8 hours. They love to check in on GitHub on the weekend or whatever it is, right? And if you say, no, nobody should ever check in after 8 hours of work. But if everybody else at the company wants to, then that company might not be for you. And that's, I guess that's what I'm trying to say, yeah.
Okay, I get what you're saying now. I'm fully on board. Working at a startup is not like working at a large company. And especially if you're new to the industry, I think this can be hard to understand. A lot of times it's easier, in my opinion, like when you're new to kind of start at a smaller-ish company, not even necessarily like a sexy startup that's like funded, but sometimes it's like a web dev agency or wherever you kind of get your foot in the door. But like even that culture is going to be very, very different. Work-life balance doesn't mean the same thing to everybody. To me, this is going to be an unpopular opinion. Can't wait to hear about this. To me, work-life balance is less about what I hear is like the healthy thing to do is like 5 o'clock rolls around, shut the laptop, put it away. Like I go have my life for 8 hours. To me, it's not really about that. To me, it's about like going to the gym at 11 o'clock in the morning is actually the most convenient time for me to go to the gym because it's empty. And because I'm feeling awake, that's a good time. So I go to the gym at 11 o'clock and, you know, sometimes I work from 8 o'clock at night till 10 o'clock PM. Like to me, it's more about integrating my life with my work, and I genuinely like that, but that's not how everyone thinks. So I agree with you. I think transparency is the solution to a lot of these problems where like, you know, you want to get a feel for the company that you're applying for, what it's going to be like. And as a general rule, the smaller the company, the more hardcore it's going to be because they're still trying to figure out some pretty basic stuff.
Or maybe not, you know, like they could be a 3-person company built trying to bootstrap and they say, you know, we want to take it slow and barely make ends meet. And then you come in and you go, you know, let's migrate to Kubernetes and, you know, where's my next raise or whatever. And it also doesn't work, you know. And I don't know, I guess, say you're a lawyer and say you're a small town lawyer here in small town Germany. Then you walk into a law office in New York City, floor 60, whatever, like a really big law firm in New York City. You will immediately know that this is a different thing. Like, this is not where you're coming from. This is not that they do. Yes, it also says lawyer on their business card, but it's a different thing. And they, you know, might not clock off on a Friday at 3, you know, and that's fine. And I think on software, in the software world, we all just lump everything into one thing. And we all talk on the same forums online on Hacker News, Twitter, whatsoever. And you don't see whether, you know, Lane is wearing a suit and me, I'm not wearing, you know, or a shitty suit or the super expensive suit. It all looks the same. Username, comment. And then we treat it all the same. But there's a lot of different subcultures and a lot of different games being played. And it's hard to tell these apart, but people should be aware that this is a thing and not have expect the same thing from everything. You can't expect to be a small town lawyer in Germany, go to your New York law office, and then say, yep, you know, Friday comes around, I clocked in my 35 hours, I'm gone. You can try, but that's not the game they're playing, you know?
It's not going to be popular. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Coworkers might not like that. Okay, this next one, this is a favorite of mine. Cookie banners are dumb.
Oh, man.
Can you explain yourself?
Do I have to? It's... Oh boy, this gets me riled up like nothing else. Cookie banners are dumb. And I wrote a tweet thread about this that went viral. Like DHH retweeted it and quoted it, because while cooking lunch with my wife, I was just opening my phone and Googling blah, blah, blah. I don't know what it was. Broccoli, whatever, cauliflower or something, air fryer, like just, hey, can we put this in the air fryer? And if so, whatever, like just the recipe. You just cannot look up stuff on the web on your phone anymore without going crazy. You click on the first result, you see the result, and then the banner slowly comes up and it's the full
out from
page.
Underneath you. Yes, so like you don't even, you click on the ad accidentally because yes. It's moving.
And it's the full thing. And then you have to three check boxes with essential cookies and the fuck, all of this. And then accept, decline, customize. And then you go, what is this? And you go back, clicks the next search result. Boom, same thing again.
But your privacy was respected.
No, like this is what drives me mad. It's not like, It's snake oil, I think, for a lot of people. Do you really think that Facebook has a database where it says, Thorsten Ball, this guy visited this page yesterday at, you know, whatsoever? Maybe there is, but even if so, no person is looking at this. Like, it's not like somebody watching a TV screen and recording of you visiting these websites. It's large amounts of data, and then you say, no, I only want the essential cookies, and then they're missing one thing. And so you're willing to pay this price that on every website you open, you have to now click reject. This is worth it to you? And, you know, 15 years ago, we all downloaded different browser because on Internet Explorer, the pop-ups were unbearable. So we all said, oh yeah, Firefox is coming out and it has a pop-up blocker. Let's switch to this. But now, through the fucking cookie banners, it's become normalized again to have pop-ups and newsletter things and this and this and that. So we're back to square one. Like, we went back in time, UX-wise, 15 years back to now have pop-ups on every website. And it's made the web unusable. And it's insane to me. It's the worst technical solution to a problem that I always thought, this is not it. Like, somebody will at any point, somebody will jump in and say, guys, let's roll this back. Like, this is not going to work. You know, yes, we want the big companies to stop tracking, right? Because that's what this is about. The goal of the law is to make sure that the bad American tech companies do not, you know, hoard data of the little man. That's what this is about. It's not about the place where I get my fucking haircut recording when the last time I visited their website or something. That's not what this is about. But they then made a law that was then implemented by the place that I get, you go to get my haircut. And in the same way, because they don't know. And my point in my tweet rant thing was, if you have a law that nobody knows how to interpret,
And everybody thinks they might suddenly be liable and people might sue them because they didn't put a cookie banner on their website. That's a bad law.
You're going to get a lot of cookie banners. Exactly.
Bad law. Like, this is not well designed. You should have said, you know, blah, 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 and then ensured that the implementation of the law confirms to its intended meaning without harming users or without degrading UX. And yeah, people agreed, I guess, but then also people were like, you know, I think that's worth it. And
has anyone ever in the history of humanity looked at a choice between, like, I want to give you information about me for free at no benefit to myself, or I don't, and chosen yes? But, like, my point is, like, the choice makes no sense because no one would ever vote the other way. Like, it's just an extra annoying click.
That's a really good point.
I don't understand why. Like, who's going to say, like, yeah, just give Facebook my data? That's like, no, either, like, change the rule around how the data is collected, in my opinion, or do nothing. Because the choice makes no sense. No one's ever going to click.
Because people also don't know what it means. Like, what does it mean? Like, if I go on a website and I buy shoes, say they go, if you accept all, and by the way, I always accept all because it's the biggest button and I don't care at this point.
Yeah. You trick people into clicking accept all because it's the primary call to action.
And that's
but if you change the text, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. But say you go on this website where you buy shoes and, you know, they say, if you accept all, we can make better, you know, suggestions to you whatsoever. And that sounds nice, right? Like, if somebody says, yeah, I'm fine with Lane's Shoe Company owning my data, I don't care, I accept all. But in practice, that doesn't make a difference, does it? Like, it's not like you then reload and it's like, boom, here's the better suggestions for you. It's, no, this is about Google, you know, Google Analytics not working. So they don't see on your dashboard whether you come from Google search results or whether you come from a newsletter or whatsoever, right? It's not about this, you know, collecting data about your locked in behavior. It's just, even if you give users the choice, I don't think users can make an informed decision on a, you know, visit by visit basis that is better than a general yes or no. And they should have implemented this in browsers. Like, it should be a browser setting that says, hey, in the browser, can I, you know, whatever, accept all or deny? And then don't ask me on every website. It's just, it's so dumb. Like, I can't believe it. Like, you have these supercomputers in your pocket. You can open them. You can query the world's information. And we turned it into a thing that now throws forms in your face. And they get so much more elaborate. And then people are proud. They're like, look at our cookie form. Look at our thing here. It has 8 different options. You can go into advanced mode. Then there's a second page in that modal where you can accept or deny. That's insane to me. It's this should not be a thing.
We have data on this from, like, a behavior to nerd out about behavioral psychology for a second. We have data on this. So, like, I believe this happened in the UK. Hopefully someone can find the study and maybe drop it in the comments. But there was a study done where it was like, okay, nobody's donating organs when they die. And let's just say it's the UK. I believe it was done in the UK. It's like less than 1% choose to donate their organs. But that's weird. It seems like more than 1% would actually want to do that. So all they did was change the default. So it used to be default, you know, you don't donate organs. If you check the box, then you would. Change the default and complete flip. 99% of people are actually willing to donate their organs and 1% of people are not. It's because nobody fucking cares. Like, it's just the default. And so to me, like, that's what a cookie banner is. It's like, I don't actually care that much. Whatever button looks nicer and is probably not going to give me an error is the one that I'm clicking because I want to minimize the time between me and my broccoli recipe.
Every time now where I live, there's not a lot of people to text. So every time I see somebody and they pull out their phone and when you show me something on their phone and a cookie banner comes up, you can feel the, you know, this 1 second of indecision where the thumb hovers and they basically go, it's 50-50, buddy. I don't know. And then they go, I reject all. You know, it's the same with, I read a tweet where somebody was saying, my answer to the question, do you want a receipt with that, is better than any random number generator. It's just random every time. Like,
do you want to receive with that? Sometimes yes, and then I throw it away or I say no. It just doesn't, it's random.
Like, doesn't quite compute.
Yeah, like, just give me the receipt. And then you realize, why did I say this? And then you throw it away. It's the same with these cookie bears. It's so dumb. Like, it's so depressing. It makes me really mad.
The next couple of questions are really interesting to me because I don't even know if you know this. So, like, this is the Backend Manner podcast. So, like, we do online education, and you have this really great, supposedly unpopular opinion that's definitely not unpopular with me. It's educators underestimate how important coolness is in learning resources. So I'm guessing this kind of played into how you wrote your books, like the Go Interpreter and the Go Compiler books. What do you mean by this?
I mean, certain educators have this sense of purity when it comes to teaching, where they think you have to start with the basics, the best, the most correct thing. Example. You're learning guitar, or you want to learn, you're a 13-year-old kid and you want to learn guitar. And then somebody says, oh, you know what? When you want to learn guitar properly, you should start with a classic guitar, nylon strings. That's how you should learn. And then the kid stops playing after 6 weeks. Because turns out, you know, I'm out of date here, but turns out all they want to do is play AC/DC. And AC/DC on a classic guitar with nylon strings doesn't sound good. So what you want is you want to light that fire in them and you want to make it look cool to them and sound cool and make it feel, you want to make them yearn for learning more, like to get better at this. And what prompted me writing this was there was a dad on Twitter saying, you know, tried to teach his kid to program. And I think the kid was like 12 or something. And they used all of the different resources, Scratch and some stuff with Racket and blah, 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 blah. And I guess their final thing was, nothing really clicked for him. And it was really hard to find good stuff. And I read through the thing and he posted, you know, links to all of the stuff. And I really thought, yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't have kept on programming with this, you know? And then a guy replies and goes, well, you should have just asked me. We, you know, made such material for our university whatsoever. All of this. This is the perfect way to learn programming. And he links to a webpage, and I couldn't believe it. It looked like my school's website from whatever, except, you know, really wholesome for today for kids. And then, hey, learn programming through the fascination of physics or through math, or hey, let's use an accounting example to teach programming. And,
you know, the super fun industry that everybody's having a good time.
Man, yeah. it was, I get it, and it's nice and it's wholesome and it's correct. And yes, this is absolutely what you should do. But it feels like, you know, I don't know, like, what's a good example? I don't know. Like, some guy wants to become a pilot, and then you start, hey, the first 2 weeks, super exciting. We're just going to learn about how to open the parachute. We're not going to leave the ground. You know, we're not going to go on a plane. But it's, dude, I want to go on a plane. You know, I want to be a pilot. I want to, you know, go above the clouds. All I'm trying to say is, man, like, you need to get people excited for the thing that you want to teach. And if you say, hey, learn programming so you can do your homework in physics, you know, on a computer, is probably not going to appeal to a lot of people. But if you go and say, here, black, you know, black background, green text, it's going to look like just in the movies, man. Like, it's, you're going to feel like a hacker, or we're going to build a game, or you're going to build, you know, like some AI thing that manipulates your friend's Snapchat things or whatsoever. You know, something might be dumb, but you got to first, you know, light that fire in them, and then you can trick them in quotes to learn the things properly. But yeah. I guess what I'm saying is they underestimate coolness. They underestimate, you know, don't come at me with a nylon guitar.
Yeah, I'm all about this. I look at it as like motivation is kind of like it's a depletable resource. And so, like, you know, you want to learn programming, you initially get motivated for some reason, and that actually runs out. It certainly runs out before you get yourself through like binary and red black trees, right? And so you need all these like fun wins and projects along the way. The thing is, like, all the information you need to learn to code exists on Wikipedia as like a raw dump of information, but you need to keep it fun. Like, nobody's actually just reading Wikipedia, right?
Well, you need to get them to click through to Wikipedia, right? And it's, I also look like all of the stuff that I learned is because I thought it would be cool. You know, like when I was a teenager, I used Linux for the first time. I only wanted to use the command line because I thought it was cool. Like, some guy on a forum was saying, burn CDs using only the command line. And I was like, how is that possible? You need like Nero burning ROM, like some graphical program just on the command line. That's what? That's cool. You mean like in the movies, like they're just type text? And that's what triggered all of this, like learning about the command line and doing this, but just because I thought it would be cool.
Text is actually badass if it's presented in the right
exactly.
light.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then same with compilers. It was, what's the coolest, hardest thing people do? Oh, you know, compilers, like that sounds cool. There's no practical application or, you know, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. We can get this, but
there's no money to be made, but like,
exactly. Cool. But it's just cool, you know, like just what? Like I can, you know, put a program in on one side and another program comes out on the other side, but they're in different languages and damn, you know? Yeah. That's my point. I think a lot of educators just miss this. And my witnesses are all of the slideshows as PDFs that I have that use Comic Sans as their font. I mean, not to knock Comic Sans, but you know what I mean. It's
I know what you mean.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm with you there. Okay. I've got one last opinion that I just want to pick your brain on. You said there are a lot of very talented, very knowledgeable, very intelligent people that just don't know how to work. Sadly, they often think they're misunderstood. What is this?
I think I put two things in one here, but let's start with the first, in that certain people don't know how to work. Meaning they don't know how to work consistently and getting paid for it and doing a good job. With that, I mean doing things that are not unpleasant, doing things that nobody else wants to do, doing things even when you don't feel like it. And it's a Tuesday afternoon or Thursday afternoon, but you're like, you know what? I'm getting paid a lot of money for this. I got 3 hours, you know, like I'm going to put in the time. I'm just going to make this work. And there's a certain type of people. It has nothing to do with, from what in my experience, you know, having interviewed hundreds of engineers and worked with, I guess, hundreds at this point, it has nothing to do with background. I've seen people from Google have this or not have it. From people from Facebook, same thing. People from small web dev agencies have it or not. Some people can come in and roll up the sleeves and just do work. They find work. They like, okay, I did this. What next? Like, what else do I need to do? Okay, let me hop on this. They see an incident go on. They jump on the incident. They help out. They clean up after themselves. They do things properly. They communicate properly. They know, hey, I'm working here and somebody's paying me money for this. And I understand that the deal here is that they get more value out of me then they pay me. That's the whole point of this. That's why I have a job. I need to provide value to them. So I am being paid to sit here roughly 40 hours a week. So I'm going to give them what I can give them in these hours. It's not always hours. Sometimes it's effort. And sometimes it's you have an intense 5 hours and you clock off. But it's about, you know, feeling this responsibility and feeling this. This is work. It's not fun. It's not a hobby. It's I'm being paid to do this. And that means I don't always work on the things that I find super enjoyable. And what I tried to say there was that there's a lot of really smart people that just don't know how to do this. They can only work on the things that they agree with and they think they make that makes sense to them or their pet thing, their pet hobby things or whatever it is. And man, like is that what you're being paid to do? Or is it that, you know, the CEO pays you or the whatever, VP, manager, whatever, they pay you to take care of this problem for them. Meaning you're being paid to build the backend for this, you and three other people. And sometimes that means you have to do this because look around, there's nobody else. There's nobody else here who's better positioned to do this. You might not like it, but hey, this is today's job. And I think that is a big thing. And I wanted to write about this. I have some notes on my phone about what to write here on this, how to work. But to add one or two thoughts to this, I
I don't know if there's any correlation here, but before I became a software engineer, I worked in not a lot, but I did manual physical work. Like I worked for UPS, I unloaded trucks, basically worked unloading packages. I worked on fields. I cleaned boats. I helped build boats and stuff like this. I helped on construction sites. And I'm saying this not to say, look, me, the blue collar guy, but I'm saying this because I had experience working in jobs where this was crystal clear, where nobody here is here to have fun or to enjoy themselves. Everybody here would be...
There was no product manager somebody, at Google Vlogs, right?
Yes. Everybody here would prefer to be somewhere else. Yes. Everybody hates this, but they're doing it to earn money. And is that a great way to live? Is that optimal? No, probably not. But I do think you need to carry some of this with you to know, look, like this is work. You know, and sometimes I don't fucking feel like it. But are you in a position to do that at this company? Like if you're like, maybe you have the standing and maybe sometimes Thursday you think, yeah, I don't feel like it, but I'm the most productive engineer this company has ever had. I can take half the day off because then I know tomorrow I'll come back stronger, blah, 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 blah. But what I'm trying to say is these are edge cases. These are special cases. But in general, you have to have some feeling of responsibility. And, you know, I'm being paid to do this. So I try to show up and do my best. And some people, they're super smart, but there's no correlation between this and being hardworking or showing up on time, doing the things that nobody else wants to do and blah, blah, blah. And the last bit that I added here where sometimes they think I'm misunderstood or whatever, I've seen people get frustrated where they go, oh, I'm, you know, so smart. I can do so many things. Why don't they put me on special project and, you know, whatsoever? And they think they're misunderstood. Like nobody sees them or values them correctly or stuff like this. When I think in most cases, it's just, no, this is not that important to the people making the decisions above you. They just want you to fix this. You know, like they don't care whether your dream is what, like building a WebAssembly, blah, blah, blah. Somebody just needs to fix the CSS today so the checkout page in our shop works, right? And it's not, they don't care about your thoughts on how we should do the whole thing better and write our own framework and how much blah, blah, blah. No. Sometimes you just got to do the work and show up and do the thing that you don't want to do and then say, you know, wasn't the most enjoyable day today, but I put in a good amount of effort. See you tomorrow.
Sometimes you get fulfillment just from the effort, which is a weird thing that like sometimes you just have to get accustomed to, right? Just knowing that you did a lot of hard stuff today. Like I have days like that where I'm writing a course for Boot Dev and like this particular chapter, I know it needs to be in the course. Damn it. I know it needs to be there. It's critically important. It's not fun to write. But like, it's just got to be written. Like, I just got to sit down and write it. And just one more point before we'll wrap up on this topic. I think it's a really good one that we don't talk about enough is as a manager, there are certain things when you say you're managing five people, there are certain things that are really hard to differentiate. Like, is, you know, employee A, is Bob a better developer than Jill? There's a lot of subjectivity there. And it's sometimes kind of hard to tell, especially, God forbid, if you're not a technical manager. But like, even if you are, it's sometimes kind of hard to tell. You know, the tasks they're working on are literally different. So you don't have a control in the experiment. It's not like they're both doing the exact same task. But something that's easier to see over, especially if you're given more time, is just like, who's working harder, right? Who's asking for tasks when they run out of tasks, right? And I think that, yeah, who's helping out? Who's, you know, who hops on their laptop at 9 o'clock when like production's down for whatever?
Yeah, and it's not even, I'm sure you don't want to say this. It's not even about hours, right? It's not even about this person is always staying 2 hours longer than the others. But it's, I have two engineers on my team. And look, person A, you know, apparently a superstar, a genius, whatsoever. But they only make my problems disappear when they feel like it. And this other person always tries to put in an effort. Like they all wave. We all have waves of productivity. It's not every day is, you know, it's not always 100%. But this other person always shows up, always reliable, always communicates back, always
tries to make an effort, even if they think, you know, ugh, why do we have to, you know, whatever, migrate to YAML, fucking, you know, take YAML again. But why do we have to do this? And they go, you know, I don't agree with this. I think there could be a better way. They voice their concerns. They push back. The engineer manager says, it is what it is. We got to do it. And they go and do it. And they don't, you know, sabotage this thing. They just try to make a good job out of it because they think at the end of the day, I'm being paid for this. And then, you know, that's a whole different thing, I guess. And I don't have clearly formulated thoughts here, but there's also, you know, the difference between, are you getting paid to make decisions or are you getting paid to execute? Are you getting paid to do stuff? And, you know, what is the thing that you're getting paid to do? And that's not always, oh, as a manager this, as an IC this. It depends from IC to IC. You know, are you a staff engineer, senior engineer, whatsoever? Sometimes it's, hey, look, like we hired you because you're the backend guy. And I just want you to take care of the backend. Like I want you to be the person that I pay so I don't ever have to worry about the backend again. And that means that you take care of this for me and not just pick and choose and the thing blows up because you didn't want to do, you know, upgrades or whatever it is. So be clear about what you're being paid to do. How do people get value out of you? And then try and do this and then you become valuable and not just, you know, doing things that you like to do.
This is amazing. Thank you so much for coming on. I had a bunch of fun. Hopefully you had some fun, just explaining what an interpreter is for the 73rd time.
Thank you.
Although you do have a great explanation in the book. So before we sign off, can you just like plug everything that you'd like to plug? You know, where can people find your book? Where can they find you? All that kind of stuff.
Yeah, sure. Where can you find me? I don't know, grudgingly. I don't know. I still tweet a lot. Torsten Ball on Twitter. I write my newsletter, registerspiel.torstenball.com. The books, interpreterbook.com, compilerbook.com. What did I miss? My blog, torstenball.com. I haven't written on that blog since 2 years, I guess. So, well, okay. Take a look. You know, there's some good stuff. I don't know. but yeah, that's it. Yeah. Thank you for having me. This was fun. I really liked your question and pushbacks, even though I guess we agree on more things than
there were a couple that I was hoping we disagreed on, and then it turned out we just dug into it. I was like, all right, I just like this guy. That happens sometimes.
There you go.
Cool. Thanks, Torsten. Have a good one.
Thank you.